This is The Takeout.
Ask not what your country can do for you.
With Major Garrett.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
At this defining moment, change has come to America.
And we will make America great again.
Welcome to the very best part of my broadcast week. I'm Major Garrett, Chief White House Correspondent of CBS News, joined as I am every week by the world's greatest podcast sidekick, Steve Shigaris, Political Director of CBS. Hello, Steve.
Hello, Major.
This is coming out on Friday, June 16th, so I'm obligated, because I am a Ulysses and James Joyce fan, to wish everyone who is similarly positioned in the literary sphere Happy Bloomsday. Okay, 1904, June 16th, the chronicled life of Leopold Bloom, immortalized in Ulysses. And I read Ulysses very late in life. It took me all of 6 months to plow through that novel. And I agree with one critic who said it is either the greatest accomplishment in English literature or the greatest practical joke in English literature. I'm on the former, but I can understand the critique describing it as the latter.
My card's in the mail for Bloomsday, by the way.
There you go. Good. I've been waiting for your Bloomsday card, for goodness sake, Steve. I've told you on this podcast that once we had one presidential candidate, Carly Fiorina, we would have more. And we do. We are joined by the former governor of the great state of Maryland, Martin O'Malley. Governor, thank you for joining us.
Major, Steve, good to be with both of you.
Welcome to the Takeout Podcast. The happy sounds you hear around us, the Dubliner restaurant right near Capitol Hill. Another James Joyce reference. Dubliners is another very famous novel written by James Joyce. This restaurant is named after Dubliners, and it is very much built in the way and style of a pub you would find in Dublin, Ireland, hence the name. So we know where we are. You know who our guest is. My Guinness has arrived, mm-hmm. So we're really off to a great start. But this has been a sobering week in the nation's capital. I don't need to tell you that. So, Governor, yesterday you tweeted the following: praying for a quick recovery for Representative Scalise, that's Steve Scalise, and all affected by today's shooting. But pissed as hell, we've allowed this to become the norm. What is the this we have allowed to become the norm?
Well, I think the this is the what I was referencing had to be with the mass shootings that take place in our country that seem to happen on a pretty regular basis.
It's not a reference to political rhetoric or intensity or division or anything like that.
No, but I'm glad to talk. But we should talk about that as well. I was thinking about the mass shootings, mm-hmm. but certainly I think this is this tragedy, this assassination attempt
can't be described as anything else
on representatives of ours to Congress. Has to be a moment when all of us ask ourselves how we might be able to better elevate the discourse of our debates. And I think all of us have a role to play, and all of us have a responsibility in that.
I talked to several members of Congress yesterday. That seemed to be among the big psychological post-traumatic takeaways of this, that how members of Congress comport themselves going forward is going to have to change if the sense of divisiveness is going to be reduced and the sense of animosity in politics is going to be reduced. Do you agree?
Yes, but I don't think it's only members of Congress.
Okay.
I mean, there was a lot of language of violence that was imbued into this presidential race, and a lot of scapegoating, whether it was to... I'm recalling when Donald Trump said that maybe some of the Second Amendment members out there or Second Amendment folks can take her out, talking about our party's nominee, Hillary Clinton. There is, when that becomes the normative behavior, mm-hmm. in public discourse in the most important elective office in our country, mm-hmm. that emanates out and to the other circles and the other races. And hey, crazy does not know party labels. There is just as much potential for violence on the left as there is for violence on the right.
Okay.
And I think we kid ourselves if we don't acknowledge that.
In that light, let me remind you of a tweet that you posted on Election Day. Hey, Maryland, polls are open till 8 p.m. Let's beat that fascist, real Donald Trump with the largest vote margin for Hillary Clinton of any state. Regret using the word fascist based on what you just said?
If one were to look at the characteristics of fascism, Donald Trump's campaign, while not meeting each of them, certainly was dinging each of those bells by the end of it. The language of violence, the scapegoating of religious and ethnic minorities, the celebration of a sort of aggressive masculinity, the a militant nationalism. These were, I'm not alone in seeing that, but over the course of these last several months, I have tempered my use of that term in order to do my part in focusing on the better and more generous and compassionate future we can bring together. Having said that, I do think it is immoral to remain silent in the face of immoral policies that run contrary to the dignity of every person that's at the center of our republic's beliefs, system, and contrary to the Constitution. And all of us have an obligation to call it out for what it is.
Steve, regardless of how it manifests itself, whether it's violent or not, do you feel that the rhetoric, the hyperpolarization that we're sort of seeing in politics these days, has it gotten to be to a level that is it too much? And how do you begin to tamp that down? It seems to me that it's almost to the advantage of the average politician to amp it up as much as they can. And it's not just politicians. You can look inward. The media does this too sometimes. In terms of having those political debates on television as well. Do you think it's gotten too much? Do you think it's part of the discourse and we can't get rid of it?
No, I think it's all become rather exhausting. I think these first 120 days, however many they've been of the Trump administration, have been very exhausting for anyone that follows their nation's politics, even on a, you know, casual basis. I do think that there is a tendency by social media and compulsion to reduce everything to 140 characters that as many people tweet on with a like as possible. I do think there is a tendency to play into that that limited vocabulary, another hallmark of fascism, by the way.
And so how do we tamp that down? How do politicians tamp that down?
I don't know that any of us have entirely figured this out. For my own part, when I ran for president and as a candidate, I always did my very best and the few debates I was allowed to take part in to handle myself with the dignity and decorum befitting of the office.
Let me ask you, before we go to break, to give us a general appraisal of the story that has been spinning around the Trump transition and the Trump presidency continuously. Trump campaign, Russia, questions of collusion. What do you think you know, and where do you think this is heading?
Well, I think that what we see here is a case with some pretty compelling circumstantial evidence, and it abounds. David Thoreau once said that you can get there with circumstantial evidence, too. Circumstantial evidence can be very compelling, like when you find a trout in the milk, and you know it didn't swim there by itself. I mean, if you look at the string of pearls here of Paul Manafort, Donald Trump's former campaign manager, the payments he's received, the source of those payments, and slinking out of the campaign when he did. You look at a member of Donald Trump's family bragging on an investor call that we've seen a lot of foreign direct investment coming in from Russian investors. If you look at the Carter Page, you look at the invasion of our public square. I mean, everyone agrees that the Russians were involved in this. The question is, what did Donald Trump know and when did he know it, and what did members of his campaign know? And I have no doubt that in the fullness of time, it will be revealed that Donald Trump, in fact, and his campaign were very much aware of what the Russians were doing. And we even saw on television Donald Trump say to the Russians, if you're listening, please go after more of her emails, Russia. This is, we're going through a constitutional crisis, gentlemen, and we'll see how strong our institutions are and the rule of law are in the United States of America.
Heavyweight words, constitutional crisis, the voice of Martin O'Malley, former Democratic governor of Maryland and 2016 presidential candidate. We will talk more about his thoughts on Russia and the Trump White House on the other side of this break. You're listening to The Takeout.
No collusion, no obstruction. We are doing really well. That was an excuse by the Democrats who lost an election that some people think they shouldn't have lost, because it's almost impossible for the Democrats to lose the Electoral College, as you know. You have to run up the whole East Coast and you have to win everything as a Republican, and that's just what we did.
Welcome back to The Takeout. I'm Major Garrett, joined as I always am by Steve Chigueras, our special guest this week for episode 22. Martin O'Malley, former Democratic governor of Maryland. So, Governor O'Malley, that was the president. No collusion, no obstruction. This is an excuse by Democrats who lost an election they should have won. You've heard that before. Pick it apart for us.
Yeah, well, I think that clearly he's already, President Trump has already admitted that the reason that he fired Director Comey was to end the Russian investigation.
Said it on national television.
And he said it, according to the Russians, to the Russians. So it's
is that by your definition obstruction?
I think, given the fact that there is a good cause for a criminal investigation to be going on with regard to the collusion and the probe, I think ultimately it will be seen to be sufficient for obstruction.
Do you think this will bring criminal charges to those around the president?
I think eventually it will. Yes.
This will lead to jail sentences for people who worked for this presidential candidate.
I think it will, given what I've seen so far, and given the circumstantial evidence of money changing hands during the election, and the degree to which the Russian propaganda arm got involved in our public square and was deeply involved in our election.
In that light, let us play clip number two.
And the suggestion that I participated in any collusion, that I was aware of any collusion with the Russian government to hurt this country, which I have served with honor for 35 years, or to undermine the integrity of our democratic process, is an appalling and detestable lie.
Governor, you know that is the voice of Jeff Sessions, the current Attorney General of the United States, the first and only U.S. Senator to endorse Donald Trump as a presidential candidate on the Republican side. An appalling and detestable lie to suggest that he either participated in, and he expanded on that to say he was, or he was even aware of, and he was a central and vital surrogate to the Trump campaign. So by his own declaration, he's saying not only did I not do anything, but I couldn't have been aware of anything. That seemed to be an attempt at a rather expansive denial. Does that in any way shake your sense of confidence about what you just said, that criminal charges are likely to be brought and brought to fruition in this matter?
No, but it's possible that Jeff Sessions wouldn't have been clued in on that degree of collusion.
Okay.
I mean, in any campaign, there's various degrees.
Sure.
And in any conspiracy.
Did you believe the Attorney General when you heard him?
No.
Okay.
I mean, no. I didn't. And I was also troubled that he wouldn't discuss whether he was involved in the reasons for firing Mr. Comey. I mean, it's kind of hard to, on one hand, recuse yourself as Attorney General from being at all involved in the investigation of the Russian collusion, and then be complicit and knowing and involved in the firing of the director when ostensibly the reason for firing him as Donald Trump later admitted, was to end the investigation into the Russian collusion.
Later admitted. So does the thing we're trying to figure out is, did Sessions know before that Russia was the reason?
Well, the fact that he wouldn't answer those questions directly, I think, allows people with common sense to draw the inference that we do in our daily dealings with other human beings.
Let me ask you this. Do you wonder if this level of Russian involvement changed votes?
I think it probably...
And therefore, what I'm driving at changed the outcome.
It probably did.
You think it did?
Yeah, I think it probably had a role, especially... I do.
In which way? Do you think there were votes that were actually tampered with, or do you think that it changed minds?
No, I think the invasion of our public square, in this case the internet, online conversations, Facebook,
troll false flags, fake news, all sorts of
stuff. Yeah, the troll farms, people masquerading as average Americans, and Pravda's buying up, those... the online bloggers with the greatest followings from that they knew, given their involvement in the Democratic primary for Hillary Clinton's opponent. I mean, all of that leads me to believe that they were very engaged and in a concerted and targeted way through social media to affect the outcome of the election. And given the closeness of the election in those five or six states where the Electoral College made all the difference, I think that it is, I think that the likelihood is that they did probably affect the trajectory of the closing days of the election.
Yet again, another example of why he is the world's greatest podcast sidekick is he bore it in on the key question. When you first answered probably, I thought you meant they got into machines and changed votes in the mechanics.
No,
you are not saying
that. No.
Okay.
I don't...
Because there was suspicion of that. I mean, that was part of the impetus of Jill Stein's, recount effort.
Yeah, there was always... And people were very wary of that. Mm-hmm. And people were unsure leading
up to
James
Comey said, no, there's no evidence of that.
Right. And there was lots of conversations about how to secure and also the weakness in the reporting systems from the state boards of election. And all of those conversations were going on. People were very highly sensitive to that. I'm not aware of evidence of actual hacking of vote tallies. They went right to hacking the hearts and minds of the electorate themselves, and they did it through our own open internet system, turning our freedom of association and speech against us.
Which is a significant act of hostility in of itself.
It is, and yes. And we have to figure out a way to deal with this. And I'm sure that there are many people in the President Obama's administration who regret in retrospect that they did not turn on the lights when they knew this was happening.
A fault of theirs that they will be historically judged harshly for?
That remains to be seen.
What do you think?
I think they should have turned on the lights. I think I've heard President Obama admit, close to that.
Right, okay, I understand that, and I know you want to be careful here, but you're a participant in the democratic process generally, and you're an active, engaged, passionate Democrat. If this was missed, that seems like a massive miss.
Well, I think I don't know that they missed it. I think they caught it, and they chose not to publicize it for fear that, in hindsight, I think you can say it was. I think not to have spoken up when there was evidence of it was a mistake that they saw in hindsight. At the time, I'm sure I wasn't involved in any of those conversations, but I'm sure at the time the president's people were wondering if, what the most responsible course was, given how close we were within that window of the decision-making of the electoral process.
Are you worried there was a political reason why they didn't do it, mainly because they probably felt at the time that Hillary Clinton was not going to have much of a problem in November and it wasn't going to matter, so why bring it up?
I would imagine that was part of the considerations, among many others, and hopefully as a nation we'll learn from this and realize that our elected officials need to turn on the lights when our electoral process and our discourse is being hacked by a foreign government.
Let me talk to you about another subject in relationship to the Democratic Party. Katiana, if you'd be so kind, play for us clip number 3. Hillary Clinton, Rancho Palos Verdes, California, May 31st of this year.
Nothing from the Democratic Party.
What do you mean nothing?
I mean, it was bankrupt. It was on the verge of insolvency. Its data was mediocre to poor, non-existent, wrong. I had to inject money into it.
This is the DNC.
The DNC to keep it going.
Your reaction, Governor.
I think a lot of people were very, very disappointed and have gone through all sorts of emotions, grief, anger, and the like after the election. I know I certainly went through some of those things as a candidate that wasn't able to open a better lane, and it sounds like Secretary Clinton is going through those same emotions herself.
Okay, that's awfully generous. Is that missing a larger point, that she must, as a good political candidate, as someone who is continuing to want to have a leadership voice in the Democratic Party, missing? Should she own up to some things maybe that she's not owning up to in that sound?
Oh, golly. Look, man. Major.
Are you sure you don't want a Guinness, Governor?
No, look, Major. I know Secretary Clinton, and I ran in this campaign, and I was an opponent of hers, and I did my very best to defeat her. I don't think I'm in a position to give her post-election advice as to how to cope with the loss. How to cope with the loss. We all cope in our own ways, says O'Malley over a Guinness here. Actually, I'm not drinking. Let the record reflect that.
No, just Major.
Just Major. The cameras are accurately recording. I'm the one who has the Guinness beer.
Hillary Clinton did talk during the campaign a lot about Donald Trump not being able to put the loss behind him if that was the case, and other Democrats said that. And now tables have turned, right? And she can't really stop talking about the loss, right? Do you think at some point she needs to focus on, and Democrats in general, moving forward, right? It is about 2018, it's about 2020.
You're doing that. You're out on the hustings, right?
How do Democrats pivot?
You're trying to get members of Congress elected in special elections and whatnot?
Right. I continue to go and help the Democratic Party, and I was in Western Kentucky. I was in Western Kentucky last week. I'll be going to Alaska this weekend. I'm helping the Democratic Party in local races. I particularly like helping out in state legislative districts, and we've had some great success. We're seeing a wellspring of activism, or maybe we call it reactivism, out there across the country. And I believe that the winning formula for the Democratic Party and the winning message is to speak directly to middle-class opportunity. That's what it is all about. The reason for the despair, the reason for the fear and the loathing, all of those things that allowed a Trump candidacy to gain traction was that people feel like they're not going to be able to give their kids a better life than they've enjoyed themselves. And that is rocking us as a nation. We know the things that can actually make wages go up and not down, that will make our bridges strong and not have them fall into rivers, that will allow families to send their kids to college without having to mortgage their own retirement. Those are the things that we need to talk about. It is not only the overarching challenge domestically, it is also a security imperative for us as a nation, and I might add how we deal with it the effects of an economy that's not working well for a lot of us, and most of us, is going to determine whether we continue to lead this world.
Those are the things we need to talk about. That's the voice of Governor Martin O'Malley, former governor of the great state of Maryland. We are at the Dubliner Restaurant. The snacks you see in front of us, chips, I think you've pretty much figured that out. Chicken fingers, I think you've probably figured that out. Artichoke dip, and what remains of excellent potato skins and Guinness. If you can't recognize this, you really ought not to be watching us at the Dubliner. That's all I have to say. When we come back, we're going to talk more about things we need to talk about and how Governor O'Malley may be doing more of that, more specifically and in a more specific political context, coming up. You're listening to The Takeout.
Listening to The Takeout.
Governor Martin O'Malley, former governor of the great state of Maryland, is joining us. A raid on the table, snacks, my delicious Guinness. That's redundant, by the way. Delicious Guinness, it is redundant. Yes. Takeout podcast stickers, all signed by me, always illegibly. That's the only way I know how to do it. That's my signature. My children, when they were very young, called that Scribble Scrabble. I think that's a generous interpretation of my illegible handwriting.
You should have been a doctor.
He has never listened to this podcast before, but he now knows that's what I say. That's the closest I'll ever come to being a physician in America.
You should see what this looks like after three Guinnesses.
Exactly. There's only one way, CBSN viewers and podcast listeners, that you can obtain said sticker. Governor, we will not take a social media request. No email request, nothing on Facebook, nothing on Twitter. You will be delighted to learn how and only how you can receive one of these Takeout Podcast stickers. Steve Shigaris, take it away.
Well, if you'd like your very own Takeout Podcast sticker signed by Major, send your request along with a self-addressed stamped envelope. Don't forget the self-addressed stamped envelope to Takeout Sticker, care of CBS News, at 2020 M Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20036.
That's old school.
I just want
very
to tell you,
old school,
we have received 153 requests to date.
I didn't know that many people still used envelopes.
Oh, it's unbelievable.
We
are keeping the envelope
industry in business. 153.
For those who ask, a number 10 envelope with a number 10 envelope folded inside tends to work best.
Works the best.
39 states plus D.C. We called out the state of Maryland the last time, and guess what we got? We got a letter from the state of Maryland.
There
so
you
I
go.
Am going to call out this week one of the 11 states that has not
one of the
sent
11.
Us a letter. Rhode Island. Get on it, Rhode Island.
Come on. Represent.
Right.
And six countries not named the United States of America. Listeners have requested their own takeout
six
podcast
countries
stickers.
And Rhode Island still not on it.
Exactly.
Let's go. Let's go back to the future of the Democratic Party with the former governor of Maryland. I have a quote from you, which you said on June 7th. The struggle for the Democratic Party right now is that Donald Trump provides so many tempting targets to criticize that it's hard for us to stay focused on the real reasons we even have a party. How do Democrats stop talking about Donald Trump when he provides so much fodder for Democrats?
Or should they?
Or should they?
Yeah, we have to be, I think we have to be very, very disciplined and bring things back to whether or not the choices that he would have us make it as a country actually increase wages, make college more affordable, extend health care to more people or not. In other words, I think we have to focus on what his leadership means and take him on. I mean, we can't go silent on the Russian collusion and those things. However, I think as a party, when our candidates are running locally and when our candidates are running whatever for state legislature, state senate, the issues that they find are most helpful is to talk about the choices that actually strengthen our middle class, that expand opportunity, that make wages go up and not down. In other words, you're not going to rebuild our nation by concentrating wealth in the hands of the few. You're not going to make wages go up for Americans by holding down wages. And you're not going to expand. You're not going to increase the well-being of Americans by shoving 24 million of us off of health care rolls. And that is the dark canvas upon which we have to paint a brighter picture for the future of America's middle class.
Do you think Democrats failed to do that last November?
I think, I mean, at the end, yes, I think we did. Look, a lot of the policies and a lot of the things that were on the website, a lot of the choices advanced by Secretary Clinton were good and sound policies. But in the fever that surrounded this unprecedented third-party candidacy that ripped through the halls of two, you know, political parties.
Meaning Trump.
It was very hard for... It was very hard for us to stay on message and continue to cut through. And there were a lot of people, I'm sure, within the Clinton campaign that were frustrated that nothing they were saying on policy was getting through. It was all about Trump. And I think, frankly, you guys have a role to play in all of that. I mean, those of you that control the media coverage, I mean, we've heard it said, in fact, that in the old days, under the fairness doctrine, we would never have given Trump all of this time. But he's good for ratings, so I say, go, Donald, go. So this is something we need to figure out as a people. In the past, we would have been able to stop a candidacy like this before it got to the level of danger that it presents to us in the free world now.
Do you think, Governor, that... if not Democrats specifically, voters generally, as they approached Election Day, said, well, it's close, but he can't win. It's not going to happen.
There's some of that.
And there was a, if not indifference, a kind of a lackadaisical attitude that people have been obviously shaken from since.
Hmm.
And I know I heard everything you said, and I've heard other Democrats say it, and I don't challenge you on the merits of that at all. But is it also a political reality that Democrats also want to hear you say, I'm sick of this president, and the morphing of every Republican on the ballot in 2018 is going to be laid over Trump and vice versa, and Trump will be the driving image and the driving wedge behind which all this other policy talk you just mentioned is going to inevitably be attached?
I think he is the reality backdrop, but I would not make him the wedge.
Okay.
I think that what we have to do is... I think that our policies will stand in much sharper relief now, and I think we will not be, and I think we have to voice the affirmative message. I mean, I've seen many campaigns, become convinced by their political consultants that the key to winning is just to go double negative against the other person and drive up the other person's negatives more than you. Well, I don't think we need to do that. Mm-hmm. I don't think you're going to drive his negatives up a lot higher than they already are. What we have to do is offer an affirmative and credible story, which means that our candidates can't, on the one hand, accept $1 million and speaking fees from the big banks that wrecked our economy, and then on the other hand say, vote for me, I'll build an economy that works for all of us and stand up to the big banks.
Do you want to be president?
I certainly wanted to be president when I ran the last time. I certainly, when I look at what's happening today, I certainly feel compelled to continue to look at that possibility, Major. I mean, look, it's a huge undertaking, and in this last time, I offered a candidacy of substance and seriousness at a time when that was not, when what the public wanted was to express their anger. The best, I saw Vice President Gore speak at Maryland College Park about a month after the Iowa caucuses, and he said the thing that he saw that was the most insightful interview of the whole campaign was a 50-year-old blue-collar, works with his hands, lifelong Democratic man, happened to be white, asked, how could you be supporting Donald Trump for president? And he said, the way I see it, our country's got cancer, and Donald Trump's just the chemotherapy we need. When that many of our citizens come to the conclusion...
How do you interpret that? What does that tell you?
That tells me that that individual, and I think many people like him, I was campaigning for Secretary Clinton, our nominee, in 19 different states, up and down eastern Ohio, it was in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and other places. Many Americans had come to the conclusion that their own national politicians had been complicit in setting the table of opportunity against the success of their family and themselves, whether it was through uncaring or self-dealing greed. And they felt that the national politicians needed a dose of chemotherapy. And when that's the diagnosis, it's hard to make the other candidate less attractive by calling him poison over and over again. And we had to, our job as we move forward here is to shift the diagnosis here and make it about the actions that we can only take together that will restore middle-class opportunity and promote the well-being of our people as a whole.
Before we let you go, you took a poll in Iowa, so that suggests you are giving some thought to this prospect. Timing is everything in life. It's very crucial in politics. I think a lot of people looking at your campaign did not fault it for a lack of substance, but maybe looked at it as poor timing, poor circumstances around it. Is that what you concluded, and do you find yourself still galvanized by the prospect and the possibility of running again?
Timing is very important in politics, and look, gentlemen, I mean, you don't know the outcome until you try. Mm-hmm. Every step into a campaign, I mean, once you decide to run, there's a step into the unknown. You don't know how events will unfold. I do believe that after our experience here with the Trump presidency, people are going to be crying out for not only responsible, forward-acting and forward-looking leaders, but also for the strong government that they once had that looked out first and foremost for themselves and, I mean, their families and the opportunity that's the bedrock of the American promise.
That's the voice of Governor Martin O'Malley, former governor of the state of Maryland, a once and quite possibly future presidential candidate for the Democratic Party nomination. As you well know, new episodes of this podcast, at Takeout, are available every Friday morning. We invite you to subscribe, rate, and comment on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. Go to Takeout Podcast, follow us, and like us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. That's at Takeout Podcast, at Takeout Podcast. Last week I asked you if you love the show to rate it and review it. You did by quite a few numbers. You totally jacked up our visibility on Apple Podcasts. We thank you for that. For those of you who haven't and are so inclined, do it. I promise you, you'll feel so much better afterwards. Governor O'Malley, thanks so much.
Thank you, guys. Good being with you.
Steve, thanks as always.
Always a pleasure.
I'm Major Garrett. My pleasure. This has been, and you know this already, The Takeout.
The Takeout is produced by Arden Farhi, Nick Feynman, Katiana Krachenko, and CBS Radio News. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter and visit takeoutpodcast.com for more information.